Good morning, everybody. You're all going to have to bear with me a little bit. I had dental surgery a few weeks ago, so my jaw's wired shut, but I can at least mumble. If you don't understand me, just ask me to repeat myself. Mr. Jay, when you're ready.
Thank you, Your Honor. May it please the Court, William Jay for the appellant, Personalized Media Communications. The District Court in this case granted judgment on the pleadings and invalidated all 58 claims in suit across 7 patents in a very short opinion. In my limited time this morning, rather than try and get to each and every one of those 7 patents, I'd like to focus in particular on the 304 and the 252 and to use those to illustrate some of the errors in the District Court's analysis. We think those errors are brought out particularly by several recent decisions of this Court that postdate the District Court's decision. I want to emphasize 3 points this morning. First, the District Court proceeded at such a high level of generality that it fundamentally misunderstood what the patents are directed to. It missed the significance of each of the ordered combinations, and it ignored how really narrow some of those combinations are. Second, these patents literally are from a different era. They have priority dates going back to 1987 or in some cases 1981. And understanding what is routine or conventional in the art has to take account of what time period the patents were submitted to the Patent Office during. The District Court's analysis gave short shrift to that. And in particular, in the context of a judgment on the pleadings, the District Court erred because deciding what's inventive in 30 or 35 years ago has to rest at least in part on understanding of facts, of historical facts, rather than just as a pure question of law. And while we're not suggesting that the District Court...
Can you just get to the specifics, particularly on the 304, because I find that the most difficult one. I mean, you're not inventing digital transmission or anything like that. It's about encryption and two-step encryption, right?
It's not about two-step decryption, because we're not claiming to have invented two-step
sure.
decryption. We're claiming a method of key distribution that certainly does rest on decryption, you know, but you know, as the court said in EnFish, you know, directed to an abstract idea doesn't mean that it involves an abstract idea somewhere.
So you're claiming the transmission of the key over the digital lines?
So there's a two-part transmission, and it is the embedding the key to decode the second part within the first part. That's really the key innovation. I didn't mean to make a pun with the word key, but in the penultimate...
Judge Lurie would like it.
In the penultimate step of the claim, you'll see that the control signal must be used to decrypt. The decryption of the second part must be based on the control signal, which is the first decrypted part.
But why isn't this just a patent on sending two types of information over a digital cable?
It's not a patent on sending two types of information over whatever the transmission means might be, because it requires that the decryption of the second has to rest on, you know, has to be based on something encoded in the first. So you have the decryptor at the at the ultimate destination.
So there's two decryptors, basically. You have somebody's gotten a first key some other way, and then you get this other package which has a new key, and the old stuff will encode the key, which will then encode the information.
That's right, and by having the second, you know, that second step, you know, the second key, which doesn't rest hardwired at the station, but is transmitted dynamically with the programming, that gives the controller of the network more ability to, number one, do station-specific customization. So, in other words, to send
out... Where is that disclosed? Where is the advantages of this claimed invention disclosed in your specification?
I think the best places to look are at the very beginning of column 148, which is the beginning of example 7 in column 148, and there are some more general statements that I think are also helpful in column 5. And this obviously is a very long specification; it covers many more than just this one patent. But in column 5, it explains some of the...
Is that exactly in the appendix?
Sure. So column 5, these are in the addendum to our blue brief, or in the appendix volume, that would be
308.
Yeah, so column 5 is 308, thank you. And so this discusses the limitations of the prior art. Right? It has no capacity for identifying. And
what column and line number are you looking at?
I'm looking at column 5. And the limitations in the prior art begin at line 38. And in particular, I guess halfway through that paragraph, beginning at line 46, the capacity for automatically identifying decryption keys and inputting them to a decryptor to serve as a key for a step of the decryption. And then the last, the next sentence but one, no capacity for decrypting a transmission, then embedding a signal in the transmission. And it goes on to discuss both there and then at the other place I mentioned.
I agree, it says that the prior doesn't have it, but where does it say why that's helpful, or whether that's a technological improvement or anything like that?
I should have gone here first. Then. Okay. So this is A379, column 148, the beginnings of example 7. The capacity to compute station-specific information at each subscriber station, and then the system of regulating means and methods. So what this is referring to, and it comes back to this several times throughout example 7.
I just don't understand how this is something that is novel or new and couldn't have been done before by other conventional means. I mean, couldn't you have had, during World War II, and maybe you did, you know, at every individual intelligence station, they had their own specific encryption key. And when somebody sent a message, an encrypted message over the wireless or whatever they were using, they would send a code and a message so that they would have a station-specific code that was the start of the message, and then the encrypted message was the second part. And they would use their code to encode the new key to get to the message. It seems very likely to me that that's been done for hundreds of years, either through pen and paper or through some other kind of mechanism, and all you're doing is putting it on digital transmissions.
Well, but putting it in digital transmission has particular advantages in the network context because you can, with a single signal, send a single transmission across the network that will be decrypted differently. In other words, it'll be received differently by multiple stations and decrypted differently. So, for example, if it says to look in your read-only memory at a particular location for the relevant code, that may have one effect at a subscriber station that has certain access privileges, and it may have a different effect at a subscriber station that can decrypt more or less. All of that can be done with a single signal without having to send one signal to station number one, then another signal to station number two, each time repeating the entire encoded transmission.
So you're saying that's disclosed in column 148?
Well, example 7 goes through a number of these things, and I think that the advantages are first listed right there at the beginning of example 7, right? The capacity to compute station-specific information, and I'm trying to unpack that a little bit. What advantage does station-specific information have? And
can you point to any place in the claims where these limitations exist?
In the claims, right? Let me answer that in two ways. Well, first, in the what the district court missed, right, was the step itself that I've been discussing. That the description has to be based on the signal encoded in the first one. But second, there are other aspects of the for example, the dependent claims for example, claim 16. Each station can store information recording how it decrypted the programming. That, and this is referred to in the specification, I don't have the column number right to hand for this, but it is in example 7. It explains that having station-specific information allows you, if you find a pirated transmission, to uncover at which station it was decrypted using which variant of the code that was sent out. So in other words, it allows for tracking and billing customization. That's the second of the advantages referred to in column 148. And then there are the other independent claims in the 304 patent go to even more specific ways of doing this encoding, ways that could not have been done just with, a one-time pad or, a codebook cipher during World War II. So, for example, using timing or location, of the signal itself as the basis for the first code that is then used to decrypt the second code.
And I think you're, in your argument, you make a step two analysis. You seem to rely on step two and saying that this is a technological improvement. How is this a technological improvement for this particular type of system as compared to other types of systems?
So you're referring specifically to the 304 patent?
Yes. Yeah, I think that's the one we're talking about.
Right, right. I mean, this is addressed, I think, in the declaration that this is an improve in the Weaver declaration that the district court allowed us to file and that but then didn't consider at page 4059 this addresses the problem of securely distributing the keys.
But why is that unique to this particular programming network as opposed to other kinds of networks?
Well, this doesn't claim a particular kind of programming network. It claims a particular kind of signal sent over the network. So,
well, I guess what I'm getting at is if cases like VDR are talking about a technological improvement for a particular system, how is the method that you've got here with the double decryption in particular beneficial for your system versus other kinds of systems, whether it be Judge Hughes's example of World War II technology or other kinds of technology?
I think that the example, that the advantages really come in the networked context versus other contexts, that it basically, it allows customization of a single code sent to multiple receiver stations to have different effects at different receiver stations in the decryption of the programming that's then sent with a single transmission. And I think to answer kind of the same question with respect to the 252 patent, which dealt with upgrading operating systems by first comparing the hardware version at each receiver station. Again, it's the same idea. A single signal sent across the entire network can have the desired effect by being received by multiple stations and having the desired effect at the ones where it should and not at the ones where it shouldn't, without having to send individual transmissions to each station directing each one to update or not update, as the case might be. I see I'm into my rebuttal time, but I'd like to make sure I've answered your questions at this point. Thank you.
May it please the court, good morning. I think the argument exposed exactly the problem. The magic in the claims apparently is in the signal itself or in the information sent or in the instructions that are sent. So no matter which patent you look at...
Why isn't the technological advantage, what your friend was just saying, that before digital transmissions, if you wanted to do this two-step encryption method any other way, you'd have to send separate messages, and that this new system and this new patented invention allows you to send out one signal broadcast to maybe, I know that it's probably not in the claims, maybe hundreds and thousands of subscribers, and with one thing, you can get a bunch of different encrypted messages.
Right, it's not in the claims. I'll go with the analogy, and I think we gave some good analogies to the district court, and the district court liked the analogies and incorporated them into the opinion. It's very easy to send the message and the encryption key, as they call it. The key's not in the claim either. But it's very easy to send that all at once. If I sent you an envelope with the message inside the envelope and an encryption on the outside of the envelope and how to open the envelope, I sent both the message and the encryption in a single message. So doing it at once, doing it simultaneously, the district court recognized is not magic. And just simply saying I'm doing it digitally, well, all computer functions are digitally. So saying do it on a computer is doing it digitally. And obviously doing it on a computer under Alice does not make an invention. The district court fully understood this, and the oral argument was extensive on each of these patents. The argument was well over an hour.
You say that the claim doesn't have the key in it. Is that because the claim is directed to control information, which is pretty broad?
Yes, and in fact... I want to get to the claim construction. I think we're going to look at the claims. They do rely on these claim constructions, and on the 252 and the 304 are the two patents, the only two patents, where they say the claim construction mattered. Well, they never explained to the district court how the claim construction mattered. The district court adopted the claim construction. The district court quoted from the claim constructions. There's no basis to say the district court disregarded anything. And if you go into the joint appendix at 3935, their claim constructions are very, very broad. And let's look at what a control signal is. And they have a definition. Control signals at the bottom of 3935, which the district court asked them to give. The district court gave PMC every benefit of the doubt and, of course, considered the Weaver Declaration. Of course, considered all the arguments that PMC could make and accepted these claim constructions even after the oral argument. And look at the definition of control signal. It means a signal that carries information or data that affects, controls, or enables processing. I don't think you could get broader than that. I don't see how sending a signal that affects processing could be any broader.
You said that the judge considered the Weaver Declaration.
Yes.
Is that because he never said that he didn't consider it? And what is your basis for saying he considered it?
I have much more than that. Yes, that's okay. A great question. First of all, when he accepted the Weaver Declaration, he accepted it by name. He said, please file the Weaver Declaration, and that's in his order. That's at Joint Appendix 4924. And he said, file your supplemental brief together with the affidavit of Dr. Alfred C. Weaver, Exhibit B to the motion. That was refiled in the docket as docket number 135. The supplemental brief was filed as docket number 134. But if we go to the district court opinion, and the reason why I know all the Weaver arguments were considered, before the district court, they did not argue step two. They had nothing on inventive concept. If you read the oral argument for the district court, the lawyer for PMC never once said inventive concept. Their entire argument was it's not abstract and preemption. They did not argue step two. Only after the oral argument did they say, let's submit Weaver, and they submitted a supplemental brief which repeated the Weaver arguments. And if you go to the district court opinion, the district court opinion repeatedly cites the supplemental brief, which incorporated all the Weaver arguments. For example, if we go to the first patent, is the 243 patent, in the district court opinion at A8, middle paragraph, it begins, plaintiff also argues that claim 13 supplies an inventive concept. The district court cites DI 134 at page 17. Unfortunately, the entire supplemental brief is not in the joint appendix, but there's enough in the joint appendix to show you that the supplemental brief cites to Weaver virtually every other sentence, cites to Weaver, Weaver, Weaver. The district court cites page 17. That brief, that page, is the novelty arguments made by Weaver. The trouble with Weaver is it's not relevant. Weaver is not a relevant declaration. He didn't do a step one, step two analysis. All he said was, this claim is novel because broadcast TV didn't do it that way. The district court understood the irrelevance of these arguments. But look at the opinion of the district court. It cites id, the next sentence, id. Those are all citations to the supplemental brief incorporating all the Weaver arguments. If you go to the next page, at A9 of the district court opinion, he even says that the method was new means of transmitting is not relevant. He's accepting their arguments of Weaver and saying even if Weaver is correct, that it's new is not relevant here. And he continues, and on each of the patents, I can show you more and more citations to the supplemental brief, which incorporated all the Weaver arguments. The point is, on a motion to dismiss or judgment on the pleadings, you're free to make any argument you want if it's reasonable, common sense, can be inferred by the district court judge. Whether it's in the brief or the declaration doesn't matter. What's wrong with the gray brief is they assume that Weaver raised controverted facts, that there's a genuine issue of material fact. That's not true. We're not opposing what Weaver says. Neither was the district court. The point is what Weaver said wasn't legally relevant. It's not legally relevant because there was no analysis of what was abstract, A matter of fact, Weaver doesn't even acknowledge anything as abstract.
Let me just give you a general question, which is, what do you think the role is of conventional and conventionality in a 101 analysis?
That's a great question, too. Weaver redefines what's conventional. He uses conventional as if it means the primary or most prevalent way. Well, that's not what conventional means at all. And in fact, this court just came out with an opinion last week in the Amaranth case. Conventional means that it's in the prior art. It was known. And we know all this is conventional and known because all these claims have been rejected, by the way, on IPRs based on the prior art. So we noticed that. There's related cases, there's related appeals.
There's the district court didn't rely on that at all.
Oh, no. That all happened after the district court decision. The district court reached its decision on its own. It was not influenced by any IPRs. The IPRs occurred after the district court decision and while briefing was taking place.
Are those decisions not final?
They are. In the patent office, do you mean?
I mean, are they on appeal here?
Some are on appeal. Some have, three or four have been denied on rehearing. Three are still pending rehearing in the patent office. We have delayed all the briefing in those appeals pending the outcome here. And that's what's been happening in those cases.
But your position here, as I understand it, is whether things are conventional or not, there's an abstract idea here, and the district court didn't err in finding that. And moreover, there's no technological improvement of the type that you'd find in DDR or something like that.
Correct. Your questions on the specification are key. If you look at DDR, BASCOM, even Intellectual Ventures, if you look at some of these cases, you'll notice this court very carefully adheres to the specification of the claims in deciding whether or not there is a technological context or technological improvement. Here, there is no citation to the specification showing any advance over the art. And they cannot show anything in the specification because the claims aren't that specific. The claims cover all technological contexts. If it's a network, they believe that's the field. That's what was the significance of their complaint. The complaint calls all these inventions platform agnostic. They don't want them to be tied to a technological field. And if you look at the complaint, which we assumed is true, they basically said Amazon, in paragraph 9 of the complaint, which is in your joint appendix, volume 3, all the procedural matters in this case are in volume 3 of the joint appendix. They make it very clear. If Amazon does it, it infringes. And that's paragraph 9 on 1453 of the joint appendix. They basically explain what Amazon does. They say Amazon sells, retailers, we sell Kindles, Kindle Fires, websites, and paragraph 9. And they say the aforementioned systems, methods, services, products are collectively referred to herein as the Amazon accused products. There's no way they can seriously, on a Rule 12 motion, act as if these claims are narrow and specific. They're not. They're alleged to be broad and not technologically specific. That's the whole point. These claims claim a functional result with nothing specific on how to do it. This court has several cases explaining this. In fact, we did 28 J letters. There were seven 28J letters in this case. I've never seen seven 28J letters. But you'll notice there was no response to my 28J letter on the two Affinity Labs cases. And one of those Affinity Lab cases was against Amazon. We've already established the legal propositions that I need today to show that claiming functional results at 50,000 feet is abstract, the true, even layman definition of abstract. They purposely abstracted the claims to cover technology that might exist someday. And they had nothing in the claims or the specification giving anything technological to teach anybody how to do anything. And that's why there are numerous examples, analogies, that would apply to all these claims to show that these problems pre-existed computers, they're not specific to computers, they cover all economic practices, that matters. We say they cover economic practices. Their response is, oh no, they cover much more than that. This is a validity case, and they're talking about the breadth of the claims in their reply brief, that they cover economic practices and more. which to me is nothing short of really the very four, five pages of the reply brief. They admit the claims are so broad that, of course, they cover economic practices.
But the judge didn't decide it on the basis of economic practices, right?
Oh, he thought it was they were broader. For example, he contrasted the claims with Ultramershal and said, look at Ultramershal. Ultramershal was a great case talking about enticing someone to listen to an advertisement to get additional material. He says, these claims are broader. Because under the claim construction, and he quotes the claim construction, this programming is much more than advertisements. It's beyond economic. It's more than economic. These claims are so broad, anybody who uses the internet infringes some of these claims, period. They essentially conceded that before the district court, and they were unable to explain to the district court how anyone can use the internet, press that shopping cart, you infringe. And that's why this is a very serious case as far as Amazon is concerned. This is the worst scenario for the patent system as far as we're concerned. And if there's no further questions, I dedicate the rest of my time to the court.
Thank you.
Thank you. Just a few points in rebuttal. I want to pick up in particular on Judge Stoll's question about what is conventional, and what my friend says is that conventional just means it's in the prior art. Now, this court has been very clear that the 101 analysis is not the same thing as the anticipation or obviousness analysis, and I think my friend's alluding to the IPRs really just makes my point. We would love the chance to litigate on the facts the questions of anticipation and the comparisons to the prior art that would underlie an obviousness analysis. But what my friends have persuaded the district court to do is to use the much blunter instrument of 101 to invalidate all of these across the board. Now, what's conventional in a 101 case is not just synonymous with it is somewhere in the prior art.
Let me ask you this. What is the role of conventionality, regardless of what it means? What is its role in a 101 case?
Its role in the second step is to distinguish between innovations that aren't really innovative, that don't add the something more the Supreme Court has been talking about in its 101 cases. So,
what he argues that you never argued step two below?
Well, he agreed that the district court allowed us to file a supplemental brief, and there's a I don't think that he can argue waiver and at the same time point out that, one, the district court allowed us to file a supplemental brief, two, the district court decided it, and three, say that it's all a question of law anyway. So we certainly have argued step two to this court, and we're arguing that these claims rest on, to the extent that they're directed to an abstract idea at all, they contain a sufficient degree of inventive step that they are something more. And the question is, now, is that something more doesn't count? Does that something more not count because it was simply routine or conventional in the art? And I think the fact that the court has been careful to say routine or conventional, explains why just saying that it existed somewhere in the prior art is not a correct definition of what it means to be conventional. So, for example, going back to the Weaver Declaration, but this is stated in the specification as well. But at 4060, Dr. Weaver says that remote reprogramming, which is the what the 252 patent is directed to, was anything but conventional at the time, because it was it could be done by individuals walking up to a computer with a floppy disk, but doing it remotely over an entire network with a single signal that would then distinguish between hardware versions. That was not conventional. And so even if the idea of reprogramming is an abstract idea, this type of remote reprogramming, done in a specific way that involves comparing a particular piece of data that indicates the hardware version and also indicates the operating system version, that's what's inventive. And I do want
to make talking about the 304 patent?
That's the 252 patent.
That's right. Okay.
On the 304 patent, I want to make sure, if I may, with the court's indulgence.
You can finish briefly.
Thank you very much. Your Honor had asked me about the what's inventive about the 304, and I didn't have the column reference to hand. At column 157, line 57, there's some more discussion of the point that I was making about why it's useful to have subscriber station-specific decryption involved in the process. I mean, ultimately, my friends say that you know, these are platform agnostic and that therefore they must be super, super broad. Now, if we were making a field of use limitation argument, my friend would be up here saying that doesn't count in the 101 analysis. What the reason that these claims are not directed to an abstract idea and that even if they were, they would survive at step two is that they rest on a narrow application with, and a specific, for, in the 304 patent, a specific construct that requires the transmission to be structured in a very particular way. Now, if we adding or subtracting a field of use limitation is not what matters for 101. What matters is that this is not broadly preemptive because of how the claims are structured. That and it's structured in a way that solves a network problem, was not routine or conventional at the time, and doesn't have a broad preemptive sweep.
Thank you,
Your Honor.